Hey, welcome everybody to another edition of Family Business Radio. We're pleased to have you with us. Family Business Radio is on every Thursday from 1 to 2 on Business Radio X. Through the Family Business Radio, we are showcasing family businesses and building a community designed to educate, inform, and support family-owned businesses. Each week, our guests include family business owners, key executive non-family members who are helping to drive those businesses, and the trusted professional advisors that assist them. I am Pat Rombaletti with Sage Executive Search, co-host, and my co-host is Meredith Moore.
Hello, Pat. How are you?
I'm good, Meredith. How are you doing?
Good.
Good.
I'm really excited about today's show, but I want to go ahead and share our statistics that we like to try to do each week about family businesses. And we've done this before, but it's especially applicable to today's show in terms of succession. Did you know that only 30% of family businesses pass to the second generation? And then, I mean, that's small enough, but then you only figure only 12% pass to the third generation. And remarkably, only 3% to the fourth generation, which makes this show so special. Our show today is the story of Pull Apart, a family business founded in 1908 that has achieved what so few businesses have. And through some various changing and with market environments, they've survived to the fourth generation and become Pull Apart, an auto salvage and recycling company.
Great. I'm excited about this, too. It's a great story. It's a great accomplishment, and we are pleased to welcome Ross Cogan, who's the president of Pull Apart. Welcome, Ross.
Welcome. Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. You're another one of the top under 40 under 40, you and Meredith. We had a guest last week, so that's a pretty elite club. And I know that a lot of that comes from both your work and civic involvement. Am I correct?
Yes. I was honored to be able to be selected as a part of 40 Under 40. And what I was especially proud of was the fact that it's a recognition of not only business leadership, but a commitment to making the community better, which is part of the values and culture that I attribute to our family over the years. So it was a wonderful recognition that was a reaffirmation of the values that I've been taught by my grandfather and my father and our whole family over the years.
That's great. And I know as we talk about the story of your family, we'll get into some of more of the details of that. I noted in looking at your biography that you did not go right from the Wharton School to the business. I think you took a different path. Can you tell me a little bit about where you went right after school and some of your previous history before joining Pull Apart?
Well, sure. After I graduated the undergraduate program with a degree, I had a degree in management and finance, and had an opportunity to go work at Ernst & Young. This is back when accounting firms and consultant firms were still the same partnership that's since pretty much been taken apart. But I worked for Ernst & Young in their small business group, helping mid-sized companies go from where they had started to their strategic plans of expansion, whether it was through people development, changes in process, talking about strategy, technology. It was taking companies from one place to the next. They wanted to go to that next level. They sort of wanted to expand out of where they were, and they tended to be larger, small businesses that were looking to grow.
All closely held, I'm assuming.
Mostly. You know, back when I was right out of college, there was a lot of venture capital money flying everywhere. You know, the stories of, you know, somebody sells a business, and the next day there's $1 million check from a venture fund.
Right.
Those days have since dissipated,
but
there were a lot of those kind of companies that had ideas, had thoughts, but really hadn't put a lot of structure and rigor. So we came in to help them put all that in place. After that, I actually went out on my own doing consulting for small businesses, helping look at companies, make acquisitions and do turnarounds. And I actually started a chemical sales company. That was supposed to then back end its way into being a chemical manufacturing company, and it was a wonderful idea, a brilliant business model. They had one major flaw. They had the wrong entrepreneur running the business, which was me. What it took to be successful in that business was not a skill set I was particularly well-suited for, so I said, you know what, okay, I got to shut this down. Let me go back to what I was enjoying before, which was the consulting, which was working with small businesses, and it was at that time that I got a call from my family saying, hey, look, we're looking at some things to take Pull Apart to the next level, to expand it beyond where it currently is, to set up some of the systems and strategy and process and technology that we want to try to think about to go to the next level, but we don't really know how to do that. You used to do some of that, right? And so then I came in as a consultant, and then from there moved into what really was a process that we have in terms of moving from the outside world into the company. We've got a series of policy and process as to how that happens, but that was my world before Pull Apart. Was working with small companies, doing a lot of that work, and then transitioned in.
Ross, is that a, would you say with Pull Apart, that's a standard practice for your family business? Are people required to start outside before they come in, or?
Oh, it's actually more than a standard. It's a written express policy and an explained process whereby you cannot work in the business right out after college. You have to have a college degree. You have to have 5 years minimum of real work experience with either a high level of professional advancement or supervising experience. Otherwise, you're not eligible to have the conversation with somebody to say, hey, we'd like to come in the business. Well, the first question is, do you check off the boxes that say you qualify? The idea behind that being you want someone to want to come in the business because of what they can bring to it and what they see in the opportunity, not, hey, it's time for me to eat a little bit of the golden goose.
Right.
You know, so we had policies that say that. And then once you have checked those off, we have a whole process of the interview process of talking to outside advisors, talking to the family members in the business, talking about how you fit into the business, writing that up, making the process structured enough, again, to reinforce the thought that only somebody who really wants to be in this business is going to go through all this rigmarole, because otherwise, why would you?
Right.
So it's one, to let people know the requirements, and it's to set a process up that prevents the company from being a place where family members go to be safe.
And I would imagine, are the other employees aware of that elaborate process so that they understand that same thing, that somebody isn't given a chair just because of their last name?
They understand it. I don't know if they know the full detail of it. And part of the reason of that is no matter what process you put in place, if you're a family member going into a family business, you need to understand that when you walk in, people are going to assume, regardless of whatever process they can prove you went to, that the reason you're there is because of your last name. And if you're totally honest with yourself, there's probably a lot of truth in that statement. So it's a recognition on our part. We want people to be aware there is some rules and structure around it, so it's not just an open trough. But we also spend a lot of time talking to, it was discussed with me, it was discussed with my cousin when he came in, a lot of time talking about the reality of the perception of you and how you need to act the second you walk in the door, because you don't get a chance to mess up, because everybody there is going to rightfully think that one of the reasons, if not the only reason, you're there is because of who your father or mother is. So you have to fight that perception from the second you walk in. No matter what process you put in place, that perception is there in reality.
So would you categorize maybe as you're held to a higher standard in some ways if you're a family member as opposed to an outsider?
Well, yes. You know, to use a completely Hollywood metaphor, you have to make your bones like you do, like they show they have to do in the mafia. You've got to show to the people that you deserve to be there. It's not just, oh, they've got a good resume. You've really got to. So I don't know if it's a higher standard or it's more along the lines of more people are going to be watching how you perform to the standard.
Right.
Somebody who's not in the family may goof up and people may not even notice it because, whatever, people mess up all the time.
Right.
But if you're in the family, you may not have a higher standard per se, but you have a slimmer margin of error, particularly when you walk in the door because of the perception you walk in.
How does that work, and even in terms of performance reviews? I mean, do you have family members doing performance reviews on family members, or how does that work with non-family members versus outsiders?
Our internal people process works the same for family members and not. And one of the important things that we have always recognized that is with each successive generation, because Meredith, you were talking about percentages go down the line, the smaller the percentages of family businesses that make it, you can also kind of look at what's happening to both the rigor and the thought and the sort of intention you have to put behind how you interact as a family, and frankly, how you interact as a business has to increase with each one of those steps. So a family business in its fourth generation, you know, we have to do a lot of things to make sure the family side of it is in place and works well together, because it's very different than my great-grandfather who started with a buggy and a horse in 1908. Well, actually started with a buggy when he made enough money he could buy a horse, and then it was a buggy and a horse. The same thing with the business. It wasn't just, okay, I have this much cash in my pocket in the beginning of the day, and at the end of the day, I've got more, and I paid my bills, so hey, it's a good day.
Yeah.
And that's how when businesses start, that's how it starts. But you know, at this point now, you have to talk about things like people process and how do people get reviewed, and you want to make sure that family members, any requirement that you have of an internal member, it's exactly the same for the family member, specifically because you don't want it to be where you've got 8,000 things a family member has to do more either. I mean, you want them to be treated like they're a part of the team because they are a part of the team. I'm a part of the team. My cousin's a part of the team. My dad's a part of the team. My uncle, you know, we're all part of the team, and we all sort of have that same basic structure that we're a part of, and we want to make sure we're all walking it the same. And if we hold the executives who are non-family members to those same rules and those same process, you're saying another very powerful thing, which is you're part of this family too.
Mm-hmm.
You've got that same rigor to you that we're applying to my son, I'm applying to you. And the same thing you're required of, my son doesn't get a pass on. So it makes a very strong message about the family and the business.
Right.
Ross, you were talking a little bit about your great-grandfather and making the large capital expenditure of his buggy and eventual, you know, taking the loan out or whatever to get the horse. And can you tell us a little bit more about the history of the business itself from the beginning?
Well, sure. Well, my family's Jewish, and when we came from the old country, which I think is what it actually said on the passport, you know, country of origin, old country. Actually, most of the Jewish people in the South lived in Birmingham at the time.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So all the trains came through Terminus or Atlanta. So my great-grandfather's brother, or my great-great-great uncle, I may be missing a great in there somewhere, but he got off the train and went to find work to get his brother to come down. And he found work so quickly, he said, just get the ticket to Atlanta, we'll stay here. So that's how we ended up in Atlanta back at the end of the 1800s. And one of the businesses that a lot of Jewish people got into at that time was scrap peddling. It was taking other people's junk and seeing what you could sell for more money, because it was at the time, a low capital business. All you had to do was be able to somehow carry the stuff to someone who had value. So if you hustled, you could start building up some value and some wealth. So a lot of Jewish people got into businesses like that. The same reason why a lot of Jewish people ended up getting into the clothing business up in the Northeast, because you could start work there easy, and if you worked hard, you could, you know, build up things over time. Same concept in the scrap recycling industry. My great-grandfather started the business with his brother. They actually ended up separating out just because they said, if you focus on this and I focus on that, we'll both be more successful. So actually, there's two corollary businesses. My grandfather started the business originally in 1908, created the corporation. It was called Central Metals and Hyde in 1917, and started what was the beginning of a scrap recycling business that was in continual operation until 1998. My grandfather and great uncle came in the business and helped grow it, and they started a waste management company that they sold off. That was a related business. When my uncle and my cousin, who was, you know, my great uncle's son,
mm-hmm.
I'm sitting here drawing a family tree, which no one can see. Got out of college, you know, they went to go work somewhere else for a while, and then they came in the family business. And in 1983, my dad came in after having worked with them to start a corollary software business that we sold, because my dad and my cousin and my uncle were all engineers. My dad and my cousin were industrial engineers and system analysts with IBM in the early parts of their career. And they took the business and they started growing it. So again, over all these years, it's the same family operating the scrap business. We've had corollary businesses. In 1996, they decided to start another corollary business, which was a do-it-yourself auto parts business. The idea being, you buy a car, you take out all the fluids to make sure that it's environmentally safe, you put it through sort of a whole process, you put it out there in a safe, clean, easy-to-use environment, and a customer can come in, look up what cars you have, go out, pull the part off themselves. Since you've put very little labor into getting that car out there, your job is to make sure it's safe and it's clean and friendly for the customer and they have the right information. They can go out, they supply a lot of the labor themselves, and you can buy a tire for $12. You can buy a door with glass for $23. You can buy an engine for $100. You can buy a transmission for $70. So this was, it was do-it-yourself, self-service, outdoor retail for used auto parts cheap. And that was the business, because the idea was, after we're done with the cars, we'll send them to the scrapyard. Hey, that's a great vertical integration. I mean, that's, you know, it's a classic business school case. Shortly after we started that company, which was called Pull Apart, the scrap business got bought, and we said, well, great, you know, that's actually not bad, because as a vertical integration, it was a terrible business. It was not a good vertical integration, but when we had the opportunity to look at the business as a separate entity, we said, this is a good business. We had customers coming in, and we had people coming in who were loving that they were working with us. We had opened up two stores in Atlanta, and it was 2002 when I got a call from my family, and they said, we are looking at taking this beyond Atlanta, trying to grow this to a sort of regional, super regional chain. Can you come help us think about how to do that? So that's when I came in. So that was the intersection of the previous story. But it is a do-it-yourself auto parts business that grew out of a scrap recycling business. And it's now become its own family business built off that. The same, actually, we have some employees who were with the old business who are some, our first employee was actually a longtime employee of the scrapyard. So the generational aspect is part of the culture, not just from the family's point of view, but also from many of our employees' point of view. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've now grown the chain from two stores in Atlanta to we've got 23 stores in 19 cities in 10 different states in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, Ohio. You know, we've got stores, you know, all over the region, and it's a ton of fun. It's a fun business. I like being in a business that not many people, when they go around, so what do you do, say, I'm a self-service do-it-yourself auto parts retail business. You? I mean, it's not the most common answer, and it's a fun business. It's a fun business because we can focus on the things we do well. It's a fun business because not only is it good business, I mean, it's good for the environment. It's good for our customers. It's good for the communities we're a part of. So, I mean, you know, we take pride in being good corporate citizens, good community sponsors. So all of that, taking our responsibility to our community simply, is the exact same quote-unquote ethos that comes right from my great-grandfather and certainly my grandfather and my great-uncle. And in many ways, it's the exact same company. This was one of the offshoots that became the company.
Right. It evolved. From our earlier conversations, I know that it evolved a lot, went from that horse and buggy to really pulling it into the era of technology. It sounds like you've really brought some technology that gives you a competitive advantage. Is that true?
Well, yeah. And our approach to technology is that we take it very seriously. And we always have, even in the scrapyard, in the third generation, made massive investments and changes for technology. And it was, internal operational. But we then, when we came to a retail business, we said, how can we take that and make it outward facing, that same approach to technology? And we were able to really change the way our industry worked with technology. And it's very funny because the other year I was at our industry conference, which is the American Automotive Recycling Association, and they had a panel on the businesses in the self-service world, which has now become this relatively established niche within the world, and everybody talking about technology. People are selling technology platforms specifically to it, and much of the functionality that everybody's talking about is new. And, you know, now you can do this finally are things that everybody started doing because of us. Huh. Because we didn't come – well, two things. One, we put technology as a strategic imperative. It is absolutely vital to any business looking to expand to have a foundation. And technology is always part of that foundation. So we've always invested heavily in it. We've never been afraid of it. It's never been one of these things that even my grandfather – who hated computers, and my great uncle, who never understood how to use them, understood once they saw them. So they got out. It never became this, we're not going to do this newfangled stuff because we've always done that, because we saw the value early. So the value of technology was always understood early, and as we've grown, we've become much more sophisticated in how we deploy it, to the point where we literally have reshaped the industry we are in. And continue to do so every day.
Excellent. We talk a lot about generational differences on this show a lot, and it sounds like the business model was so ahead of its time, because you look at Gen Y right now and this very big DIY type of community, and, you know, obviously being green and recycling, and you guys were doing this for, you know, decades. So it's kind of interesting. Are you seeing any differences in perhaps your clientele, and not just the automotive guys, but even just the public coming out there and some of the younger generations wanting to get their own parts, so to speak?
Well, we always joke we were green before it was cool.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been doing recycling since there's been recycling being done. You know, what you have seen is with businesses that do it right, over a decade or so, a business that handles itself right in a recycling industry, you don't so much get different people in our business, largely because you've got to know how to take a part off a car.
Yeah,
so if you don't know how to take a part off a car, it doesn't matter how badly you want to do that, you can't do it. Maybe you hire someone to do it, but to us, we still see the same person. Mm. What you do see is you see in public comments, which you see is responses to your communal efforts, which you do see is at, you know, state representatives, state senators, you know, governor's offices recognizing you as an environmental company, which 10 years ago, there would never been a company in anything related to our industry where they would have called them, you know, Georgia's Sustainable Business of the Year.
Right.
We never would have been recognized as sort of the key component of a state sustainability day. You never would have won environmental awards for air and waste management quality. You never would have been part of the EPA's premier programs in multiple sites, along with the biggest corporations in America. I mean, those are things that you would never see before. But by looking at it, and ironically, this is actually something that a lot of the credit doesn't, in fact, go to the family for its implementation, but somebody with whom we've worked with for 30 years. Who's really always been at the forefront of recycling and has always preached to us the value of using innovation as a differentiator and an ability when you walk into a neighborhood community and say, I'd like to put a business here, they say, well, these guys are different than what we might think. It gives you a chance to have that conversation.
Right.
So what we've seen, the difference is not so much on the customer side, but on the community side. And as I said, we take that aspect of our life very seriously, because when we buy a piece of land and invest, we're going to spend a long time there. We want to be a part of the community.
So it kind of expedites as you expand. It's it was done for the right reasons, but it's having a really good effect, it sounds like.
Well, sure, because like I said, we used to get the cars. So, you know, we didn't want to – the old problem with the industry was they just would pass it down to the next person. Well, we were the next person, so we had to do it right always, not only because it was the right thing to do environmentally, it was the right thing to do for business. And when those two line up, that's when you get real change in a green and sustainable, whatever you want to call it, way. Those two factors lining up is where you start seeing real differences being made.
Yeah, that's what they call it now, because that's the sexy
hip.
Part of it. Yeah.
Well, now we're sexy. It's good. I like
it. That's great. You know, we talked earlier about your entering the business and the kind of formal process of the hiring. Is there a formal onboarding process for family members as well? Is there something specific?
Oh, sure. Well, we have what we call a 2-year probationary period. Which is really the opportunity for both the family and the person who's coming in to have a window by which if you were to spend a year and a half and all of a sudden go, you know, I thought I was going to be this. Mm. It's really that. Guys, I want to get out no harm, no foul. Mm. You know, because the truth is that you don't go into a family business like you go into any job. You go in, you should plan to stay there. But recognizing that things don't always work out exactly how everybody thought prior to actually doing the work, we created this 2-year probationary period, which also includes where they work with a family member as a sort of a mentor and have a training program. They try a couple of different areas. All the structures, you know, requisite with a job are sort of locked into place so that for 2 years, it really is an exploratory process to make sure that the fit that we thought through the hiring process was there remains for both parties. Because even more so than when you're hiring a senior leader or anybody for your company with a family member, it's even more permanent.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So we've created these tools or tricks or policies or whatever you want to call them to be able to allow us to be aware of the potential road bumps before they happen so that we can deal with them in a proactive and productive manner.
Excellent. Sounds like a great process. Do you have any outside advisors on your board or is just...
Well, you know, we have outside advisors. When we were talking about as we move down the generations, you have to have, as I was saying, the business becomes more complex and more things are required to run it. We recognized we needed outside advisors to help keep us honest on certain things, to be outside opinions. But what we also knew is we didn't want outside directors because there's a certain bit of, know thyself. Mm-hmm. If you're not going to respond well to a director that has the requisite authorities and responsibility of a director, you shouldn't take an outside person and make them a director of your company just because that's what all the textbooks say. You need an outside board of directors. You know, what do you need it for? We needed outside advice. We needed people to help keep us honest to our commitments that we made in terms of the family dynamic and family policies and business policies. So we said what we need is outside advisors who can give us opinions with whom we have regular meetings like a board. And there are small numbers of areas where they do have a vote, which are the areas where the reason why they're there is most important. But on all the other areas, they're advisors because we know that's how it would work well with us. And we've had the same advisors for many years. They're wonderful. They've helped us through, you know, a ton of processes, both thinking-wise and actually mechanically. They've helped us avoid conflicts because they reminded us, remember, guys, this is how you said you were going to resolve this, and let's do that. And then we do it, and we realize, you know, it's pretty smart how we set that up. Mm-hmm. But no, the advisors are great because, A, they're quality people, but, B, they've been clearly communicated with about what they are supposed to be there and not. Mm-hmm. So they are not worrying about running, you know, 7 different committees on the board. They're worried about their specific expectations. And we were very clear with that, and that's why it's worked so well, because we set up expectations that work well with us and communicated them.
You know, you said you had a formal process for handling. What is that like? What is it? A panel, or how do you handle conflict?
Well, you handle conflict. We have two primary vehicles. One is we have set up, for lack of a better word, all of the our disagreements we could think of in advance and sort of talk them through. And here's how we're going to handle that when this comes up. And here's how you go through all the potential disagreements in your mind, and you argue them before everybody's worked up and upset because it's actually happened. So then when it happens, you get upset, everybody gets PO'd, and then you go, right, wait, we talked about this. This is what we said we're going to do. And it kind of creates a release valve at the moment.
Right.
Additionally, sort of on the back end, we have a process by where if somebody feels like, hey, you're not listening to me, you're not hearing what I'm saying, I'm going to bring a formal charge or whatever you want to call it of this issue to the board, to the outside advisors and to the founders of the company. And then there'll be, I'll have to write it up. You're going to have to write something up. We're going to have to go through a whole bunch of documentation. We're going to have to go through a process of discussion. And for lack of a better word, it's like a mediation. And what it does is it makes you go, do I really want to act in a way that's going to cause that? If I'm really that upset, do I want to go through that process? Or are we going to try and head this off at the pass and handle this in the right way? And the combination of the two things have allowed us to maintain productive working environments. And we disagree all the time, but it'll never get to the point where it's beyond control because we've put those speed bumps in sort of the anger, right. The anger accelerators. We put speed bumps in front of them so that we have things that make us stop and go, wait, we got to think about the family and we've got to think about the business. Let's make the appropriate decisions and let's not. And then the fact that you've taken that breath, that alone allows you to go, okay, what is it we want? What is it that we need? Let's make a real decision. And then you move forward. And we've never had to go to the, what I jokingly call the nuclear options of mediation or whatever. I mean, it's never been that kind of thing. But the process is set up there in a way that everybody thinks would be fair if we had to. And like I said, it's kind of like mutual assured destruction. By having the arsenal, you never want to get involved with it. So it keeps the level of discourse where it should be, which is productive for the business and the family, not, over-amped.
Exactly.
Ross, with your family's success in the actual succession of the business, and that's a common theme on the show, can you talk a little bit about, are you able to speak at all about how you guys have been able to set up some sort of succession plan or what was involved in that planning process?
Well, there's two significant factors that I think are important with succession that we've had. One, the people who have come into the business because of our approach really want to be there. So there's kind of a business as a holistic view mentality of everyone in the family, which makes the discussion of succession not one of power, but one of what's best for the business. So that leads to the second thing, that you go through a process of discussion, and then when it's time for the next generation to take over, the previous generation has to figure out, how do I let go and let them do that? And if I see them, they're making a mistake, I don't talk to the person with whom they're making a mistake. I don't talk to the customer who's upset. I talk to the family member who's now in charge. And you sort of talk about it before. What are you going to do if you see me not treating an employee the way you want? You don't go to the employee, or when the employee comes to you, you don't go, no problem, Joe. You and I have been working together for 15 years. Let me go talk to my boy. That undermines the whole thing. He needs to know his answer is, you need to go talk to my son. And then the previous generation can stand up and walk down the hall and close the door and go, we got to talk about something. There's some things that aren't happening. Give me your side, I'll give you mine. But they have to figure out how they're going to let go. They can't just, because the problem is you can't just go, great, we're going to let go. Because that's just, all you'll see is somebody holding on to something saying, I've let go. But if they have rules so they know that if they need to have influence and opinion and that they can have that, but they can also let go because they know they've got that. So the combination of the right type of people coming in and the right type of discussion and process generationally, that same idea of having those disagreements in advance, have allowed the previous generation to let go largely and sort of accept the new generation taking over because they feel they're not worried that if they're going to drive, they're going to drive them off the cliff and I'm never going to have a chance to hit the brakes. They know they've got the opportunity to hit the brakes if they need to, even though they're not driving anymore.
Wow, that's a great program.
With the family being there at work all day, talk to us a little bit about how you guys are able to balance the any family gatherings you do outside the business. How does that work?
Well, there's two parts to that. One is part of what we do together isn't just business. It's community work and philanthropy. So because we've committed to doing that together, there's a very important piece there. We have things that just as much as business, we talk to each other about, both at business and not, that's just as important to us as work. So we've built the habit of talking to each other about something other than business. Mm. We do a lot of community work together. Sometimes somebody will be in one organization and somebody will be in another, and they'll sort of share ideas and talk about things. But the reality is that we don't just talk to each other about business. We've spent as much time talking about community work. So very important. We built the habit of not talking about the business into even the people who are in the business. Mm. Second, and just as important, we have regular family gatherings, not just for big events, but every Friday night we go have Shabbat dinner at my grandmother's. I've been doing it since before I was born. And my grandkids will be going to some form of Shabbat dinner with the family. It's been a wonderful tradition. And what's happened over the years is very early on, when it was my great-grandfather and my great-uncle and my grandfather, everybody said, we can't talk about business at the table because we'll just talk to each other. We'll never hear what anybody's done. We'll never get any update with the kids. So it became the rule, no business at the family table. And after a couple of generations of the grandmothers yelling at everybody, now we self-correct ourselves. I mean, sometimes we'll bring things up and go, oh, sorry, that's business. You know, we're not talking about business. It's, you know, so we don't talk about it at the family table because, A, we've got other things we've learned how to talk to each other about, and B, we've said it's a rule. And after a couple generations, rules become law, and you don't just overturn law. And if it's a grandmother's law, it's not just a law like it is in Congress. It's a law of nature, and you cannot fight it. So having those kind of simple things and habits in place, well, now we've had four generations of dealing with each other, not just talking about business. So, again, a lot of it is about the rules you put in place, and particularly the disciplines you put in place to make sure you don't break them, so that you can then build habits. You know, I'm a big fan of habits. I always use a quote when I'm talking. You know, Aristotle used to say, excellence is not an act, it's a habit. Mm-hmm. We are what we repeatedly do. So if you are always with your family and talking about business, you've built that habit. But if you've built the habit to not, you'll self-correct yourself when you start going into it when you're not supposed to. So it's by having both something we do together that's not business and having rules that we follow about how we gather. You know, so now any family gathering, we don't have to talk about business. So sure, you know, occasionally I'll pull my dad aside and we'll have a quick conversation in the corner. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but that doesn't become the central focus of us at the family gathering, or even worse, becomes a central focus of the family gathering.
Right.
So that's kind of how we've done it. It's a combination of the philanthropic and community work and family discipline and family routine that gets built on committing to the positive habits that relate to the value of making the family about something more than the business. Mm.
You know, a lot of family businesses get so bogged down in the day-to-day, and it can just suck you in, and then they don't think. But listening to you, it has occurred to me that you, as a family, have stepped back and looked at the business and the strategy, big picture of that, and also, you know, you talked about preserving the family. You've looked at what are the rules of which this family will operate within the business and define those way ahead, whereas certainly 90% of the time in any business, and especially so in family businesses, those things are decided in the heat of the moment or after the fact when everybody's stopped talking to each other and they have to deal with it. Do you have a formal meeting process? How did you get to that level of really strategically planning both the way things operate as a family in the business and the way the business operates?
Well, each generation, as they've sort of come into the family business, has said, how are we going to think about the next generation? Hmm. And that really comes from, in my eyes, comes from my grandfather and my great uncle, that generation. And so each generation, as they've come in, has sort of further refined the rules and the requirements, much like, so when I came into the business and my cousin came into the business, we said, you know, we have to take our turn, you know, sharpening it up. So, you know, there was, a, you know, so but each generation there's been sort of a family process. So it's that part is a continuum. Mm-hmm. You know, all actions are driven by beliefs. And if the beliefs are what you're doing in your life is for the next generation as a part of it, you're thinking about that in your actions. And that's always how we were brought up. And so when you come into the business, just like when you do it talking about community or anything, we're always thinking about the next generation and how can they can engage with us and then after us. So it's always been sort of part and parcel, and I don't know if I wouldn't say so much as intentional, as much as it's just how it's natural. It's how it's happened. So when my cousin and I came in the business, we recognized we had a lot of the pieces in place. Why don't we put a formalized framework around it, which has, you know, twice a year, all the family members who are involved with the whose families are in the business get together so they can hear what's going on. But also at that meeting, that's when we talk about the family philanthropy and we talk about how are we going to think about things for the next generation. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not all about the business, even at the family meetings that are brought together because of the business. But again, it's, you know, we said rather than wait, you know, we learned from our parents that they had a lot of things that could have become huge issues, but because they had things previously in writing and previously agreed, they never became issues. My cousin and I, along with our parents, we said, we need to structure this to the next level to make sure that you don't get into any of the situations where a son comes in the business who may or may not be qualified and doesn't have to go through a process and it becomes a whole thing. And then why my son this and your son that? And, you know, you avoid all that. And mm-hmm. and you, if you communicate with the family in ways that, again, reinforce the value of the business is what it is and the family values are what they are and our community work and charity is what it is, they no longer go, I don't understand why you're doing all that, what you're doing with this. And, you know, why are you doing that? I know why you're doing that. Remember the last 10 years, I've been sitting in meetings and saying, I agree with this. Do you think of that? You listen to me. I listen to you. I understand what's going on. And it's not this black box of you don't get to understand it. It's this great, wonderful tool for wealth creation, you know, God willing, over time and enjoying business and being a productive part of the business world and having a tool for family cohesion and teaching family values and making an impact on the community that's important to us and sort of the world that we're a part of. And if we look at it as a tool for that, the way you approach it is very different than it's my kingdom. It's our family's tool for what we do.
Excellent. And do you have... So none of the non-family executives are at those semi-annual meetings?
No. The non-family executives, we have obviously, I've got a CFO, I've got a guy who runs my operations, I've got a VP of external affairs, and we've got a lot of senior top people who are not from the family. They, obviously we have weekly meetings and monthly meetings, and we have quarterly meetings with the board of advisors that they're a part of. They're continually... shoulder deep, knee deep, head deep. And I don't want to imply that sometimes we don't get caught up in the minutiae of business. It, mm-hmm. it happens a lot. But we've got mechanisms in place that make sure we have to stick our head up from the weeds and look around and make sure we're still can see the horizon. And in fact, the horizon we're heading to is the one we've been planning to and not wake, you know, you can get you keep your head down and lose that way. But if you put mechanisms in place, both with your outside advisor, where you have quarterly meetings, frankly, even from a business point of view, if you've got specified meetings where you're not just talking about what do we got to get done in the next 24 hours, but the next 24 months, you know, that's part of the purpose of the meeting. You know, the whole executive team can pick their head up. But from a family point of view, having the outside advisors meetings quarterly, the semi-annual meetings with the family gives us those opportunities to, I always use the phrase, you know, pressure release to make sure that you're not just barreling forward without stopping, to look up. You go, okay, yeah, wait, did we do the things we said we were going to do? All right, why didn't we do that? You know, which is
exactly.
Why didn't we do those things? Oh, okay, that makes sense, or that doesn't make sense, or, you know, I guess we have to start doing that now.
Right.
All of those things have happened over the years and will continue to happen. But by having those processes in place, nobody goes, you never told me, I never knew. You know, when we've had hard times, you know, we've been very forthright and upcoming with both our senior management in the company, with our family, with our advisors. And again, it's, I feel it's because we build good habits and we try to, particularly at the onset of a process, build in the good habits and good reinforcers for all these things to remind us of the values and the actions that we think are important with it.
You know, the process that you described about having all of the, you know, kind of having a playing forward the movie of what if this happened, what if that happened, and then having very specific, has that translated down to the rest of the employees outside of the family? Do the individual managers relate that way? It's a brilliant strategy if they do.
I would say it has filtered down more in a matter of culture than, mm-hmm. than process or policy. Where disagreements are never handled with yelling and fighting and emotional mm-hmm. outburst and that kind of stuff, because so that part of the culture translates directly.
Right.
And there's part of the culture where we spend a lot of time talking about anticipation.
Mm-hmm.
So those two, I would say those are symptoms. Part of the, and to a smaller degree, yes, I mean, certain things, you know, think about what would happen if, think about, you know, when you've got an employee that, you know, we do a lot of that. We haven't made it quite as structured, probably because I think it's got more power in the culture than it does as a set of policies, because it's the set of policies at the family level that have created the culture. And really, there's nothing more powerful than a company's culture. You can fight a lot of things in a company, but you can't fight its culture. You can change a culture, but you can't fight it.
Exactly.
That seems to be a common theme with what we're seeing with our family-owned businesses.
Yeah.
I would actually argue it's not – family businesses, it's actually just a stronger culture because it comes from a family set of beliefs. But that's true in any company. But in a family business, any family business that wants to sort of keep moving forward has to be aware of its culture because it's even harder to change.
And has it been hard? You're growing. You went from two. Keeping a culture in two locations is pretty easy. Now that it's 23 locations, has that put a strain on keeping that culture, or have you found a way to do that?
Well, look, it's always harder. You know, the comment we often tell our managers is the problems of a 16-year-old are more than double the problems of an 8-year-old. The problems of running 23 stores is more than double the problems of running 11 stores mm-hmm. or 11 and a half stores, mm-hmm. but we don't have half stores.
Good math.
Yeah.
Do you have to go to Penn to figure that math out?
Yes, yeah. That was actually a seminar in my senior class where they explained you have to do things, you know, in fractions, and then right. they have to cut apples in half. It took me a long time, but eventually I got there. It's being aware of the impact on its culture is an important part. And actually, when we had 6 stores, we started a process where every quarter all of the managers would come in. So they could meet everyone at corporate, obviously meet everyone from the family, so that at least once a quarter, everybody's touching everybody, so that there's not just structural and beliefs, but also literally physical actions that reinforce that, so that people don't feel like they're out on an island, feel like they've got someone to call. And then obviously we go spend out a lot of time visiting them, but then everybody coming in together once a quarter to be at corporate, to be with everybody who's there, to meet everyone, to have a face, to go out and grab a drink and shoot pool and do all of those things does a lot to reinforce that culture, because it's harder to keep just from a day-to-day operating point when you've got a distributed business model.
Yeah, absolutely. So 23 stores, what's the future of the business itself?
Well, we're going to look to keep expanding. We are going to, you know, we're very opportunistic. Our family philosophy has always been look for value, see where you can create it, and then when you hit on something, we can really expand. So we're always looking at, are there other markets we can go to, other complementary businesses that may make sense. Right now, in the current environment, it's very smart to look at how do you make sure that you're, you know, girded up for strong times and make sure that you're minding your core business. So, mm-hmm. you know, part of what we're doing right now is making sure that we are focusing on providing the best service, the best value to our customers, making sure that all of our stores are doing it in the best way possible so that we've got as strong a core as possible, as strong a foundation possible for whatever the opportunities we happen to stroll across. You know, we're going to keep on growing and, you know, opening up more stores and who knows where else from there. As you know, our family does have a history of having several lines of business, so that who knows what could happen. But we look for value, we look where we can create it, and then we do what we can.
And have you, you know, kind of looked on that crystal ball and thought about what some of the challenges might be on the horizon?
Well, obviously, if you look to other businesses, the biggest problem you got is what I call the left-hand, right-hand problem, which is that somebody's got to be running a line of business with their right hand. And my apologies to any lefties in the who could be listening or who are in the room. But somebody's got to run the business with their right hand. So you can't just say, great, we'll start selling cars because, you know, hey, we know something about buying cars, so let's try to sell cars.
Right.
You know, somebody is so great, you know, Tom over there who's in head of this, that, and the other, you know, he can sell the cars extra as they happen. You know, no, you got to have somebody whose focus is a line of business to make sure that they're operating right and they're accountable and they have the control, which is the other side of accountability. You can't give someone control unless you give them that the accountability unless you give them control.
Right.
But you want them to do the business, somebody to do another business with their right hand so that you're going to get the best out of your investment. So that's obviously one of the biggest challenges of how do you make sure you're not defraying your attention, because we're very much, we believe in a lot of focus. So another line of business, you know, we have to figure out how to handle that. The biggest challenge, there's two big challenges as we grow as a business, and then as a family, it's a little slightly different. Obviously, expansion is extraordinarily difficult. Dealing with governments and in a heightened regulatory world is a monstrous challenge. Cannot overstate it enough. Mm. The guy who we have who does our external affairs and government affairs is an angel. He's got the patience of a saint, and he's unbelievable at what he does. And we have a horrible time at it. I think we're as good as it as anybody, and it's impossibly difficult on a good day. Mm. The other side is that if your operating methodology is keep it simple, stupid. You know, we are KISS personified. As you grow, to use the physics term, entropy sets in. As systems get bigger, there's a tendency for things to move to more chaos. So how do you work your you-know-what's off to keep it simple? Simple doesn't mean easy. It doesn't mean dumb. In fact, it's extraordinarily hard and, frankly, extraordinarily expensive to keep things simple. And was it Leonardo da Vinci who said, simplicity is the ultimate in elegance or something like that? You know,
right.
Elegant business solutions that are simple are extraordinarily hard to find, and that's kind of what we are constantly driving towards. So those are the business challenges as we grow. The family challenges are really in three places. One, how do we keep the culture?
Mm.
You know, and as you get bigger, you just have to always ask that question. Two, how do we make sure that we are true to all the previous agreements? You know, how do we make sure we keep ourselves honest to that? And three, how we make sure it's still fun. Because the fact is that if you're in a family business and it's not fun, you're no better off than being in any other job you hate. So, you know, how do you keep it fun as you're growing with all these serious challenges? How do you keep the culture? How do you keep all those things together?
Yeah, a lot at stake. You know, you have shared some tremendous wisdom with us and great insight.
My grandfather.
Yeah, I will. Clearly, it has been passed down, and much of what you shared was clearly coming from the roots of your grandfather in that first horse and buggy, or cart and horse, I should say. And we always like to end our guest appearance with some tips for our audience that might be some words of wisdom that you could share with other family business owners. And we would love to hear three of those from you.
Well, sure. And I'm going to hit on three things I've been discussing before, which is one, and I cannot overstate this one enough, have your disagreements in advance. Spend time thinking about where you could disagree. Write it out. Write out your responses. You know, so that's the sort of the corollary part of that tip. Have your disagreements in advance. Have your agreements made on the disagreements in advance. And if you haven't written it down, you haven't agreed on anything. So that's one. The second, do not force your kids into the business. It should not be some safe place where they go. you know, there's a story, a classic story in my family is, you know, kid finishes college. He goes to the family business and he does a project. You know, he was an engineer, and his father goes, "What do you want to do?" And he goes, "I want to go around and tell you how to make this business better, Dad." So the kid goes around, comes back. He has a big fancy report, all of this stuff, and none of it's really relevant to the business. And he goes, "And in conclusion, Dad, there are 14 people at this business who you don't need." And the father is quiet, and he looks at him and he goes, "Well, after this report, you'll be done and you'll leave. And that number will be 13. The business should be a place that kids want to go to for the business. It should not be a situation where the father or the grandfather is saying, "You're going to be here," because that's how you kill the goose that laid the golden egg. You know, that's why we have all of the policies and, you know, bureaucracy, for lack of a better word, that we've chose to put in there, is because we want to make sure people who are coming into the business want to come into the business. And then, of course, the converse of that is once they come in, you're ecstatic because somebody's not just said, "I'm going to come in," but, "Hey, I went all through this. I'm ready to dive in, you know, head first, foot first, you know, deep dive with you because I'm in." You know, so don't create a situation where family business is the safe place. Don't force your kids in the business. And the final one, which is probably the most important thing in my mind to why I think we've been able to succeed generationally, why I think we have a family that I love spending time with, not dread, which in and of itself is statistically a low
exactly. number. That's lower than the 3%.
Yeah.
Is make your family about something more than the business. Hmm. Don't make everything your family interacts with be about the business. Whether it's philanthropy, whether it's community service, whether it's family gatherings, whether it's a hop, make sure that the family's identity is not tied up in a business. Because a business is a business and a family is a family. And when they work together well, you've got an extraordinarily powerful thing. But if you don't remember that they're two separate components that you have to manage to make them work together, if they become one, you've created a lot of potential problems and you've left a lot of value on the table. So have your disagreements in advance. Don't force your kids in the business, and make your family about something other than your business are the three things I would say are the most important tips I could give somebody who's thinking about how do we take our planning and our thinking of our family business beyond the first generation.
Great, Ross. Those were great tips, and I'm sure some of our listeners out there will be able, hopefully, to use and implement some of those.
And I want to remind our listeners a couple things. You can go to our website, which is familybusinessradio.businessradiox.com. And in a few days, by Tuesday of next week, you'll be able to download this podcast. You'll also, as of now, be able to go there and see the contact information for Ross and the headquarters. Ross, where are your locations here in Atlanta if somebody wants to go pull apart tomorrow?
We've got one up in Buford Highway, one right off Moreland Avenue at 285 near the airport, and one off 20 East off Lithonia Industrial.
And if they want to go on your website, how do they find that?
www.pullapart.com, P-U-L-L-A-P-A-R-T.
Great. Thank you so much, and thank you, our listeners. We look forward to visiting with you again next week.
Have a great week.